Good afternoon. This is case number 26-1348, City of Philadelphia against the Secretary, U.S. Department of Interior et al. Mr. Indeberken?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Indulgence. There we go. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Dragan and Birkin, on behalf of the United States, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
The district court in this case issued a sweeping mandatory preliminary injunction that dictates what the National Park Service must display at the president's house and how NPS must operate that federal site. It bars any and all further changes to the site, including installing replacement materials, and requires the city's mutual agreement. It further imposes a continuing operative and operational mandate. That mandatory injunction gives a municipality veto power over what the national federal government says on its own property. That mandatory injunction cannot stand for multiple reasons. First, the city of Philadelphia's claims suffer from numerous threshold defects. The city lacks standing. The Tucker Act diverts contract-based claims to the Court of Federal Claims.
Which of the counts do you see as Tucker Act claims?
I think counts 1 and 2 are squarely Tucker Act claims, and count 5, the ultra vires theory, to the extent it relies on the same contractual right and seeks the same remedy, it's subject, as the Supreme Court has instructed, the same statutory limitations as ordinary claims, and therefore count 5 would be barred as well.
Do you see count 1 still in play?
The district court seemed to indicate that it agreed that claim was barred, but it didn't actually dismiss the claim. And the city has argued before this court that count 1 essentially provides an alternative avenue for affirming, or
the city didn't cross appeal though. Right.
So we looked at that early on when they raised it in their brief, and as long as the substantive right to relief that the court would award, or which the party, the appellee, is arguing for, is the same as what it originally gained, no cross appeal is necessary. That said, to the extent it would be more expansive, and to the extent they seek a more expansive type of remedy than they obtained, at that point a cross appeal will be necessary. But given that they have argued that count 1 remains in play, I think this court does need to consider whether it is or is not a viable claim. And under their express concessions before the district court, where they in their briefing conceded this is a breach of contract claim seeking specific performance, I think there's no question that it is in fact a contract claim based on the Tucker Act and subject to the Tucker Act. Separately, the...
Is it your argument that all contract claims are going to have to be governed by the Tucker Act?
Any contract-based claim against the federal government that is not somehow susceptible to a different type of remedy or cause of action, yes, under the express terms of 28 U.S.C. 1491, all that statute says is any express or implied contract. By that in terms of that statute, yes, contract-based claims go to the Court of Federal Claims.
The city argued below that it was the Little Tucker Act controlled. Why is that incorrect?
They originally raised that argument, and then in their amended papers, the district court withdrew that argument because they realized that that was incorrect under governing law. And the main reason for that is they don't seek a monetary amount under $10,000. So the Little Tucker Act is inapplicable here. Further, the city has no valid cause of action. Its APA claims do not challenge agency action, let alone final agency action. I know the court has directed specific questions to that. I'll get to that point slightly later. Of course, indulgence on that. On top of that, the conduct of the city challenges is necessarily committed to agency discretion by law. These types of curatorial decisions by the Park Service are inherently not subject to judicial review.
There's right, no... You put a lot of evidence on the notion that this is curation, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But the city's position seems to be, and we'll get clarification in a minute if I'm misunderstanding it, but the city's position seems to be that what is going on here is not curation, but elimination. Is it the government's position, federal government's position, that you have the power to eradicate all statement or acknowledgement of slavery at the president's house?
I think the government's choice of what to emphasize at the president's house, whether they emphasize a particular stage of...
I'm not talking emphasis. I'm assume for the purposes of my question that I agree with you that you retain the power to choose what to emphasize. I'm asking whether the federal government has the power to eliminate
any reference to slavery at the president's house site.
Yes.
I think inherent in the curatorial decision is the ability to make that decision if they thought it appropriate. That said,
there's unfettered discretion there.
On curatorial decisions, yes. I think to the extent it would alter the actual structure of the site, that may be cognizable under a different type of cause of action.
No, say you keep the structure there, but you remove the names of the nine people that were enslaved there. You remove any statement of slavery. You're saying that that's okay.
I think it's important to recognize that given now that the new panels have been posted on the Park Service website, that is not what's happening here or what's planned. At the same time, if the federal government elected to instead emphasize or discuss the life of President George Washington and John Adams during their time at the president's house without discussing slavery, it's their prerogative to make that decision.
All right.
But there's no reason for them to do so, given the fact that the whole meaningful purpose and connection of the site is because it illustrates the slavery topic.
All right. And the reason you say you have that discretion is you say it's federal property. It's not state property. The documents indicate that the city turned it over and donated it to the federal government. The National Park Service has to maintain it and control it. Those are all your arguments, correct?
There's also an overarching one, which is no specific statutory framework governs site level interpretive decisions.
All right. That's what I want to get to, because there is the National Underground Railroad Act from 1998. And this site was designated under that act in 2022, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And if you're going to have a site designated as an underground railroad site, how could it possibly comply with federal law if it had no mention of slavery?
So I think it's important to actually discuss that question with reference to the text of the actual Underground Railroad Act. There is in that statute also no site level interpretive obligation. It establishes a program under which property sites programs can be designated at the discretion of the secretary if they have a demonstrated connection to the Underground Railroad. But after such designation, there is no particular provision in the statute that says, and this must be displayed at the site and this must remain there. And that makes sense because it's not just federal properties that are designated on the site. Privately owned and other operated sites with a historic connection to the Underground Railroad can also apply and obtain designation. That designation doesn't come with some sort of prescription that the property owner must then put up particular signage or maintain particular signage. The connection and the designation is based on the historic connection to the Underground Railroad. And the reason that we know that there's no particular prescriptive site level designation is because Congress specified in the Underground Railroad Act when such requirements actually do exist. There's a narrow provision that talks about grants that the secretary provides under the act, which is 54 USC 308-303, in which under the act, the secretary has to, as a condition of providing such grant, specify that conversion, use, or disposal of the property for purposes contrary to the purposes of this chapter, as determined by the secretary, shall result in a right of the United States to compensation equal to the grant. Meaning those grant provisions have to have a clawback provision that prevents use or conversion of the property that's inconsistent with the purpose of the act. But that's the only situation in which there's a restriction on use or purposes of the property designated under the act by itself.
All right, so even though Oney Judge was the reason it was designated, there doesn't need to be any exhibit honoring her or mentioning her.
That's
correct. As I understand your position, you don't have to do that, but you're doing it anyway. If we looked at the website or the documents.
Yes, actually, one of the proposed replacement signs has a whole section on the National Underground Railroad and discusses the significance of the site in Philadelphia in particular and the connection thereof. It also still lists the names. It discusses the actual lives. It discusses that Ona Judge escaped and was hunted until she died. But yes, the discretion itself remains the same. And I think the reason that makes sense is if the site had been designated before any exhibit had been created in 2006, based on archaeological or historical evidence that there had been slaves at the president's house and the Underground Railroad had a connection, that would have been acceptable too, without any sort of president's house exhibit, meaning the designation is based on the connection to the Underground Railroad, not interpretive exhibits thereon. On top of that, the designation remains. Changing the signs, taking them down, has not in any way altered the designation. The secretary still has the site designated. The site will remain designated. That hasn't changed. And I think important to remember that the hypothetical Your Honor posed about removing all reference is not this case.
So earlier in response to one of Judge Hardiman's questions, you said that's not what's planned. What is planned?
I think at this point, given that the Park Service has posted on its website their intended replacement signs, those are the ones they intend to install once they're able to do so and are not subject to an order that prevents them from doing so. I was discussing agency discretion by law. On top of that, even if we get past the discretionary piece, the city failed to establish a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. They requested and obtained a mandatory preliminary injunction, which this court has instructed has a particularly high bar. They need to establish that they have a substantial likelihood of success and that their right to relief is indisputably clear. They have not. Their statutory claim, the principal statutory claim they bring, is predicated on 16 USC 407N. As we explained in our briefing, both the district court and the city have misinterpreted that provision.
You're reading that specifically to the historic site, correct?
Correct.
And it's your understanding the city and the district court expanded that to include the entire park?
Yes. The district court opinion, by its explicit terms, expands that term to cover the whole park. And the city in its briefing has defended it on that basis. Their only statutory defense of 407N specifically embraces the notion that the site was merged, absorbed into the park over time, and with it, their right to veto any alterations likewise expanded. They cite no authority for that notion. It also is inconsistent with the plain meaning of the statute and fundamental principles of statutory interpretation. There is no reason also, no logical, sensible reason that Congress, when it drafted this statute, would have intended for the city over time to gain more expansive authority over federal property. It made sense for it to specify and protect the city's own property. As long as the site was city property, specifying that that must remain the actual property of the city and that no alterations can be made to that property made sense. There's no sense.
When you say city property, you're talking about Independence Hall itself and it, the adjoining buildings.
Precisely.
And Carpenter's Hall. Not city property, but that the Carpenter's.
Precisely.
Union or organization owned it.
Exactly. So 407N, right, naturally, authorizes two types of cooperative agreements with two non-federal entities. One with the city to govern the site, one with the Carpenter's Company of Philadelphia to govern Carpenter's Company.
And it's your position that the mutual consent requirement applies with respect to those specific properties.
By the terms,
Carpenters have a right, they have a say in what happens to Carpenter's Hall, and the city has a say in what happens to Independence Hall and the adjoining buildings.
Exactly. And the reason we know that is because Congress wrote that in the statute. It says the cooperative agreements are with those two entities, and those agreements shall specify that no alterations or changes shall be made to those properties.
The 1950 Act's a little fuzzier than that, though. The 1950 Act seems to express some forward-looking intent that the park would expand over time and that the federal government and the city of Philadelphia would act cooperatively as that park expanded. Isn't that right?
I think I agree on the first part, not necessarily on the second part. I think the act, without question, explicitly contemplates future growth
of the park. Over time, it authorizes the secretary to acquire additional properties and to determine essentially what the scope of the park shall be. But there's no indication, no explicit statutory indication that Congress expected the city's right over the park to also somehow expand. I think that's exactly why the 1950 agreement reads the way it does. It essentially delineates the specific obligations and rights of both parties. It has the new alterations to the property within Independence Square language, but also has a sort of purpose provision that governs the party's intent and their pledge long term. Notably, there's so
let me ask you this language. I'm reading from section E. It is the purpose of both parties to this agreement to develop a unified long-range program of preservation, development, protection, and interpretation for the whole Independence National Park and for the inspiration and benefit of the people of the United States, and to secure this result to a high degree of cooperation. Wouldn't that suggest that the government's understanding was that this expanded the agreement to the entire park?
I think the fact that that's separate from the actual specific language that gives them an actual right to approve before any alterations are made actually contradicts.
Judge Restrepo is reading that passage, but if you keep reading down the passage, it ends with, quote, "and the parties hereto pledge to consult themselves on all matters of importance to the program," quote. So do you think that program is, you've got a pledge of consultation, not with respect to a site or to a park, but to a program? Isn't program of those three choices, site, park, and program, the most general?
I think if you look at the first sentence of that provision, which reads that it is the purpose of both parties to this agreement to develop a unified long-range program of preservation, development, protection, interpretation, that the program in the last sentence refers back to that program. And I think it doesn't expand the actual term of the site or the right of mutual agreement. I think it expresses a general intent. And it makes sense because Independence National Historical Park sits in the city of Philadelphia. It makes sense the parties hope to proceed cooperatively and intend to for the long range. That is historically how the relationship has been.
And if they don't, do you think that the city would have standing to challenge that?
None. There is no enforcement provision in here. There's no actual right to veto. There's no more expansive obligation. It essentially
isn't that a merits-based answer? If there is no pledge, if the pledge consultation doesn't take place, why isn't that a cognizable injury in fact, like it would be for many other contracts?
I think that that's answered by the Supreme Court's procedural right jurisprudence. So we discussed this in our brief, and what they've held
I think what you're going to say, I think you're going to cite to Summers v. Earth Island and then the recent Brown Heroes Act case. I don't want to step on your toes or read your mind, but that's what you said in your brief. But both of those are procedural rights tied to statutes, not procedural rights that derive from contract. Doesn't that matter?
I don't think so, absent an enforceability provision. If you contract with someone and have specific terms, and in the course of drafting that contract, you also express a procedural pledge to consult, and rather than allege a violation of a specific obligation or burden, the contracting party sues for a violation of that right, it's hard to see what their injury is
Is there any case law to that effect in the procedural rights space? I thought it was all statutory procedural rights, not contractual procedural rights.
I think although the cases we've cited deal with procedural rights based in statute, I think principle transfers because the very notion of an injury in fact hinges on a concrete, particularized, substantive.
So does a person for a breach of contract action in federal court have to show an injury in fact? Or with breaches of contract actions already recognized as cases or controversies at the founding such that no injury in fact is needed for such a claim?
I think you still need an injury in fact. I think there's no case that I know of that essentially says for breaches of contract claims, a de facto breach without any cognizable harm is in and of itself sufficient. I think we analyze breaches of contract claims under the ordinary principles of Article III standing, which require injury in fact. And I think a mere procedural violation of a mere alleged violation of a procedural pledge without some sort of concrete underlying substantive interest that's affected by the violation does not result in an injury in fact. It's unenforceable. And I think that makes sense if you look at this contract. There are specific provisions that undertake obligations and that bind the parties in which they commit to do particular things and give each other rights. This is a praise-portatory type of provision that essentially expresses a general intent without any enforceable piece. On top of that, even if this court were to hold otherwise, and this case were to be resolved on that basis, all that would have to happen is for the Park Service to inform the city of its intentions, and then it has consulted. It would be meaningless. There's no point to this provision because it doesn't actually give the city the right to veto anything or to prevent anything.
I don't want to double back to the previous point, but at various points in time, you say, this case is barred under the Tucker Act. Or we can't hear the case in this forum because it's a Tucker Act, but you just kind of said they could never pursue this. There would be no standing, no Article III standing anywhere. So isn't the Tucker Act kind of a point that you're making a little bit illusory? If when they showed up in the Court of Federal Claims, you said, nope, sorry, no standing here either?
No, I think no. And the reason for that is these are alternative separate arguments. So the city's argument of a violation of the 1950 agreement and 407N is more expansive than just predicated on the procedural pledge. They posit that the agreement and the statute apply to the whole park. It's more expansive. It doesn't hinge on the procedural pledge violation. Now, putting that argument aside, they also seem to suggest and argue that there is an independent violation of this procedural pledge, which would survive even if the site is interpreted to be just Independence Square, because the pledge applies to the whole park as opposed to just the site. So the fact that the procedural pledge by itself may not be enforceable or may not provide injury doesn't mean that under their view of the law, the broader first line argument or argument that there was a breach of this agreement isn't cognizable by the Court of Federal Claims. I think moving on, the AP, so that's the Tucker Act piece. I think separately, they rely on various agency documents. For the reasons explained in our brief, these do not actually provide enforceable standards of law. They impose no specific obligations. They disclaim binding enforcement effect. And the cases that the city and the district court relied on do not support the notion that non-binding internal agency documents can support APA claims for review.
We can hear you on rebuttal on that. I think it would be useful to hear what the city has to say about that first. We understand your argument that this isn't cognizable under the APA. So
I think that leaves the ultra vires claim. That one fails both because it's subject to the Tucker Act.
Is that just a derivative claim? Is that how you see that?
I do. And I do think, given that there's no specific statutory prohibition, which the Supreme Court has identified as required, that
it's hard to act ultra vires of something that doesn't order you to do anything.
Exactly, Your Honor. Okay. So that's likely to success. That leaves irreparable harm. As we've argued, the harms identified by the district court are two indeterminate and not legally cognizable forms of irreparable harm. On top of that, the actual exhibits could be restored and reinstalled or entirely replaced if need be at a cost of $20,000 in approximately 3 weeks. There's no actual irreparable emergent harm that required this PI. On top of that, there's the overbreath and the mandatory nature of the injunction. It wasn't tailored to the nature of the violations found. Numerous provisions, including the continuing maintenance obligation, the snow sweeping provision, and the TV operational provision have nothing to do with the claims that were alleged, which have to do with the actual removal of the exhibits. That's not even an APA remedy. On top of that, That's specific performance, which brings us back to the Tucker Act.
Is the lead time for the exhibits that you want to display 3 weeks also, or is it a different lead time?
I believe at this point that the new exhibits have been manufactured, but I think the installation may take more time, but I'm not entirely clear on that. At the same time, given what we know about the original exhibits and given that they would essentially take up the same amount of space on the same spots, I would assume that 3 weeks and the same cost is reasonable to infer. With all that, right. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Taylor?
Good afternoon, Ann Taylor for the City of Philadelphia. Your Honors, with your permission, I'd like to start with the question that the court directed to the parties on Sunday evening. Notably, what is this in terms of an agency action? So 5 U.S.C. 551.13 describes agency action as the whole or part of an agency rule, order, license, sanction, relief, or equivalent thereof. And as this court has recognized in the Gentile case from around 2020, this list is exemplary, not exhaustive. But specifically, 551.10d describes sanction in part as a destruction of property. And so here the property is President's House, and the destruction is the removal of all the panels that give the President's House meaning. So where we stand, and I do want to emphasize for purposes of this record, there is nothing in the record that anything other than removal was contemplated by the federal government when this happened. Some of that is because this was fast moving, but also because at the preliminary injunction hearing, the government did not put on any evidence of an alternative. So what the court is dealing with on this record is the President's House as it existed on January 21st and the President's House with no panels.
So what do we make, Taylor, of the government's representations today that the replacement panels are up on the website?
So, Your Honor, respectfully, those can certainly be considered by the district court in assessing, you know, to the extent those were contemplated or design and works before the agency action here of removal, those might be part of a more fulsome record that the court would consider in considering whether the federal government appropriately thought of the various factors and the overlays that are applicable to this site. And so that may be appropriate for the district court on remand, but for purposes of this court, they're not in the record here today. So talking then,
we need to focus on whether the federal government had the power to take down the displays.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And it really is that discrete question.
All right. And let's start with what I think we might agree on. And if we can't, then correct me. The President's House property is not and was not owned by the city. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And the city does own Independence Hall and the adjacent buildings, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you agree that the distinction that the federal government is trying to make here, try to separate or distinguish the 5-acre parcel of Independence Square from the 55-acre parcel of Independence Park, is a meaningful distinction?
I think certainly for purposes of some of our claims, that can be. I think.
All right. And the district court agreed with you that the city's rights weren't just inherent in the 5-acre parcel, but in the larger 55-acre parcel. That seemed to be a key pillar of the district court's decision, was it not?
So the district court's decision looked at that and considered where Congress had passed the 1948 Act, identifying that Independence Hall National Historical Site was owned by the City of Philadelphia. And that was specifically different from Independence National Historical Park, which Congress created in 1948 and directed the use of cooperative agreements for the federal government to engage with the city. 2 years later, the cooperative agreement issued, by which the federal government, in fact, committed to an enhanced working with collaboration with the city for the program for the whole of the park. Now, interestingly, with that, Congress wasn't done with Independence National Historical Park at that point in time. It revisited the scope of the park in several enactments in the late 50s, in the 60s, in the, and then I believe in 1996 was the last time Congress examined and touched on what is Independence National Historical Park, what is the scope of the park. Ahead of any of those, Congress presumably would have been aware of the 1950 cooperation agreement and the enhanced scope that the secretary committed in terms of engagement on the park itself, particularly because the 1950 agreement is only capable of rescission by an act of Congress. So it is a different type of vehicle to reduce the collaboration between the city and the federal government.
I think the federal government concedes that the 1950 act remains in effect.
Indeed.
But then we get to 2006 and the run up to this particular site and the three amendments that followed. And the city clearly had contractual rights in those cooperative agreements, correct?
Well, and I think if I might, Your Honor, yes, and. So those agreements also really frame out what the president's house is, and particularly why the city has residual interests in the existence of the house.
All right. Well, that's what I want. You're ahead of me. So in a good way. As I read these agreements, the city has clear contractual rights. If for example, the party that was selected to do the exhibits, the federal government vetoed it, then the city could have gone forward. If the excavation wasn't being done according to the agreement, the city could have gone to court. There were a lot of times the city could go to court while the president's house was being established. You used the word residual, and I think that's important for us to understand what tail rights or what ongoing rights, if any, the city has, because what you're running up against is some language that says, once the site is established, the president's house is established, the city donates the property to the National Park Service, and the National Park Service then retains the obligation and the duty to maintain, interpret, et cetera, the site, correct?
And yes, and all of that, even stepping before, Your Honor, what I would suggest or say that the record reflects is that all of the work that the city did and the public taxpayer dollars that the city spent was to create, and this language is throughout the record, a permanent outdoor installation. So that is what the president's house is. That is what the city built, worked collaboratively to design and donate.
Where's that language, permanent outdoor installation?
So you can see that, and that's in the record through all of the joint press releases that the city and the National Park Service issued together.
Well, you're not going to get a contractually enforced right from a press release. So what contractual document says that you have a permanent outdoor installation?
It is not in the contractual documents that I recall standing here. It is, however, describes, and when I say the city has a residual interest in the existence of President's House, that is because that is why the city spent taxpayer dollars to build it and then donated it with, and I think that it's fair to say the contractual documents all demonstrate a stewardship expectation of the federal government as it took on the maintenance care of this site.
So Ms. Taylor, the structure's still there, correct?
The structure is still there.
The building, the walls.
And
the walls with the names of the folks who are engraved and the footprints are there.
Correct.
Is it the city's position that the government can't curate its property?
That is correct, Your Honor, because this is not an act of curation. And that is why I emphasize that everybody understood this to be a permanent installation as it was designed, planned, and installed. So that is specific to the site.
That sounds like that once they put up the exhibit, it had to stay that way forever.
And Your Honor, so
is that your position?
That standing here, what I would say, any changes to that, any potential changes could be and should be done consistent with overlay of the foundation document. So as we look
Before we get to the foundation document, do you have enforceable rights that the exhibit needs to stay as it was first installed forever in the future?
So, Your Honor, with that, I would say the third attachment to the 2009 cooperative agreement is the overlay of what this site is about, what is it is expected to have in it, and any interpretation is supposed to be consistent with. So within that and with the interpretive guidelines it provides, there's a reasonable expectation of ongoing existence of the exhibit, and then the activity around the margins of it would be consistent with that project plan.
I guess I understand why the city would expect
that when the president's house was erected with the exhibits and the talent that was procured and paid for to do the exhibits, including the videos, I understand why the city would have an expectation that that would stay the same for a while. I'm having trouble understanding why the city would have a reasonable expectation it would always stay that way. And let me give you an example. What if history is changing? We learn new things. What if we learn that there were in fact 12 slaves instead of 9? Is it the city's position that it would have been illegal for the National Park Service to do new panels, new exhibits, and add 3 names to the wall?
So, Your Honor, what I would say is it's the city's position that any such change, and of course, history does develop, but any such change would be considered and appropriately considered by the Park Service, consistent with the overlay on its own discretion for changes to this that it put in place through the foundation document.
So could I just get in, you know, this third amendment to the cooperative agreement has a paragraph in Article 3B, paragraph 17. It's on JA 315. And it says, quote, consistent with the partner's intent to donate the project to the NPS, as stated herein, waive any claim or right to any property interest, including use rights or to compensation for any project components donated to NPF on behalf of the partner. And that was something that I understood was part of the city's agreement, because Article 3B is what the city agrees to. Doesn't that kind of, Judge Hardiman was asking earlier about, you know, we've got residual and we've got tail. Once the donation happens, isn't the city out of luck?
So, Your Honor, I would suggest that use does not contemplate the lack of existence. So at this point, what we have with the president's house is without the panels, the president's house has donated no longer exists.
But you know, use was just one of the things it said. It said including use rights. It says waive any claim or right to any property interest. Like, you do you think you have any property, the city has any property interest in the president's house or its exhibits or otherwise?
So, Your Honor, what I would say, instead of a property interest, the city has a residual interest in the existence, right? So in terms
of— That's a contract interest, not a property right.
Well, and also it's a more—
like, no, I'm asking.
Oh, yes. I think that is it is explained at least in the contracting documents.
It's residual of what? It doesn't have to be residual of the property that the city previously owned. You call it a residual interest, but I guess my question is residual of what? It's not residual of the contract, because the contract is what just did. You're saying it's a residual. It has to be residual of the prior property interest, right?
The city never had a property interest.
Correct.
If I'm not helping you, then correct me, but I'm trying to help you here. Yes. I thought your argument was that the city had a contract-based expectation that what happened in January of this year would not happen.
I think there is a contract-based expectation illustrated by the contract documents that give the city grounds, much like in an environmental case where there's non-pecuniary, non-property-based interests can be sufficient for Article 3 standing to state an Administrative Procedure Act arbitrary and capricious claim about agency action. That is more akin to the contracts describe the city's reasonable expectation in the existence of this property. The city's claims are about how the federal government pursued its actions at this property.
What do you make of the 2006 agreement, Ms. Taylor?
The
language specifically on ownership of the exhibit, I'm sure you're familiar with it,
mm-hmm.
where it reads, upon completion of the exhibit in accordance with this agreement, ownership of the exhibit shall transfer to NPS.
And
so did the city give it away?
So, Your Honor, what the city did there was transfer the intellectual property rights, and there's testimony in the record about the understanding was that NPS needed those property rights so that it could monetize the site, so create saleable items about the intellectual property at the site to then help support maintenance of the site.
What do we do with that language?
So again, with that language, I think much like I just said, it shows, yes, that the city transferred this with an expectation of stewardship, but throughout it, the residual property right is the expectation of existence. And that falls in that Article 3 cognizable interest of a non property non-pecuniary aspect in which the city can then contend that the way the federal government went through and did or did not deliberate did not comport with requirements that it ought to have done.
So at the end of the day, the city's position is that any decision the government makes with respect to curating exhibits has to, the city has a sign-off authority.
The city, no. What the city's position here, and this is specific to our claims and that are articulated under the with respect to the foundation document, Network to Freedom, and also 407, is that the federal government has to duly consider what cabins its discretion in those spaces. So for example, in the foundation document, the Organic Act gives the secretary, you know, it directs the secretary that, excuse me, let me find the exact language. Sorry, so the Organic Act directs that the secretary needs to take action and run the parks consistent with the statutory purposes of the park and with the system purposes of the system units. So within this particular system unit, the federal government, particularly the Park Service, laid out what the purpose of the system unit is in its foundation document. And so what the court can do is evaluate whether, based on an administrative record, again, here there is none, whether and to what extent the Park Service considered and appropriately considered the foundational resources and values that the Park Service itself applied to this park system unit. And so whether the Park Service, before taking the action of removal, considered that collaboration and partnership is a foundational resource and value for this park, whether they considered that the archaeological resource of the remains of the footprint of the house, before taking all information about those remains out, if they considered that in making their decision. But so the cities can make those claims and has standing to make those claims.
Is count one still in play, Ms. Taylor?
In terms of count one, Your Honor, that is the city's cooperation agreements. And I think where that comes into play and the argument the city made there in briefing to the court, and as the United States acknowledged, it's a argument made in the record. So we are here before the court on that as an alternate basis. The cooperation agreements here are wholly different in kind than the types of contracts that are barred from consideration by the Tucker Act. So I would highlight for the court that there's no exchange of really any money in these. There's nothing that suggests these are procurement-like contracts. And further, that these are contracts that just reduce a course of conduct between the two of them to writing. So it is not something that is itself even cognizable in the Court of Federal Claims because there is no monetary relief. And respectfully, that the United States and Judge Hardiman, you were saying earlier all the times we could have gone to court on the 2006, the court specifically contemplated by parties in there was the Eastern District of Pennsylvania.
Well, that could well be true, but that doesn't mean that the parties could agree to violate federal law. Federal law says it has to go to court of claims and it has to go to the court of claims.
And I would more suggest that it shows the parties' understanding that this was something other than a contract controlled by the Tucker Act.
One other thing on the foundation document, is that part of the National Park Service's management policies?
So that is, I believe, in addition to the management policies. So the management policies dictate sort of overarching behavior within the Park Service. And then the foundation document really gives granular insight into how the Park Service considers this park in particular, so Independence National Historical Park. And if I could just briefly on one point that came up in the briefing that I did want to touch on is the city is not saying the federal government has to comply with the foundation document, right? This is different than the cases cited by the federal government, Cumberland, it was Cumberland Island, Norton, even the PADHS case about the grants administration manual. The city is not using these to say there must be compliance with the foundation document. It is that the foundation document is appropriate to consider when looking at how did the government go about its business in making this decision. And that actually the Davis versus Latcher.
Right. So you're saying it's not legally enforceable like a contract, but it is evidence of arbitrary and capricious administrative action.
And it sets up what the federal government ought to have considered because it has put an overlay on its own discretion in this space. So the Davis versus Latcher case cited by the federal government, that expressly says, yes, the Organic Act gives a significant grant of discretion to the Secretary of the Interior, but the Secretary can then cabin that that discretion by issuance of his or her own internal policies and guidelines. The foundation document serves as that cabining of discretion for this site and is thus appropriately examined by a court when looking at whether and how the federal government made its decisions before taking down the panels.
Could you go back to 551?
Yes.
And you pointed us to 10D, destruction, yes. Taking, seizure, withholding of property.
Correct.
Whose property?
Your Honor, that's not defined in the statute. And so with that, it I don't know if it could be the federal government's property or it could be a non-federal agency's property, but it's not defined therein.
And waivers of sovereign immunity are construed strictly in favor of the sovereign, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so if the word property could mean anyone's property, that's one reading, or if it could mean only the property, or it could mean not the federal government taking its own property, there'd be no reason a regulating agency taking its own property, that would be another reading. We would have to pick the one that was more favorable to the waiver of sovereign immunity, right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can you get back to where you started? I want to hear more about your argument that this was final agency action because it was a sanction.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to support that? I wrote down that you indicated that a sanction was destruction of property.
Correct.
And are there cases that say that or regulations or statute? Where are you getting that?
Your Honor, we're getting that just from the plain language of the statute itself. I know there is one case out of the, I believe, Fifth Circuit out of Texas, but other than that, frankly, I'm not sure this is a litigated provision that much, but when the court instructed, arguably order could apply to this case, but most clearly on the statutory language, property does. So that would just be for agency action. In terms of finality, there's no record in there. There's no evidence in this record of any further action by the federal government, that nothing again in the record as it stands to suggest this is interlocutory or partway through. As the record stands by virtue of the preliminary injunction, that what was put in the record there. And then in terms of the effect on the city, the kind of legal consequences, obviously this is not a case like a rulemaking where there might be then the city, necessarily changes its business because of a rule, but instead it is the consequence to the city of this not being here is that the city will not be able to, the whole point of building the president's house and part of the whole point was for the city to tell its history. And that is what the federal government recognized as the basis for why the city could spend its money to build this. That is now gone.
That gets back to whether this is permanent or not. Then the tail rights or the residual rights.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's a tough one because you donated it. You said that the National Park Service had to manage it. I understand why the city would expect it to remain for a long time or a while at least, but I'm not sure it makes sense to think the city would expect it to stay for 50 or 100 or 300 years. I mean, things break, technology changes. After a certain period of time, those videos would look pretty, if we think about the black and white televisions of our childhood, well, my childhood, not yours.
Mine too.
Not yours. technology changes. So it stands to reason that those video displays after a period of time would be in need of replacement at least, right? Even if you wanted to keep the content the same, you would want to swap them out for something better, right?
Well, and Your Honor, I might say
just help me with this. Is this a one-time permanent thing that could never change? Is that the city's argument? Or that it could change, but it had to change in a way that the city endorsed?
It could, as we discussed, history does change. Videos can break down, but that changes should be consistent with the park's own foundation document and also with, and this gets to the city's broader.
All right, but what if we say that foundation document doesn't provide any legally enforceable rights for you? What's your fallback position?
So we're not saying that it is legally enforceable. We're saying that to the extent the Park Service was going to change it, it would have to consider what it identified as furtherance of the legislative purpose of Independence National Park. That's the instruction.
No, but I'm challenging you on the prior mm-hmm. foundational question, which is what rights, if any, does the city have? I mean, the city spent millions of dollars. City invested in the site. The city was working hand in glove with the federal government during the Bush and Obama administrations to stand up the site. All of that's clear in the record. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to hear an argument from your friend about that. But I'm asking, what did the city get for its money beyond the erection of the site and the establishment of the initial exhibits? Mm-hmm. Did it also get that those things could not change for 10, 20, 50, or ever?
Your Honor, it got a sort of yes and. It got an expectation that this site would exist as designed. I think it is also fair to say it got an expectation that changes to this would comport with the 80 years of collaboration that have occurred at this site since it was founded.
So if the federal government were to change the foundation document to completely rewrite it, would the city then have a claim or not? Because it seemed to me that you were saying that so much of the reason that we want to look at the foundation documents to kind of, I think the city, the federal government says it's in its reply brief, to set the yardstick. It's the document by which we're going to measure. Were there judicially manageable standards? Was this arbitrary and capricious? But what if the federal government were to change that? So that it didn't include any reference to the paradox of freedom and slavery? You wouldn't have a claim then, right?
I don't think we would have a claim that we would win, right? Because having a claim is, do we have an interest in the site? Do we have a successful claim? If the foundation document, the yardstick was changed, we might then not have a successful claim.
So your claim really comes down to, in one level, the standard. It might not create you rights, but it creates the standard on which we're going to evaluate the National Park Service's action. And that is that there has to be, I guess I'm rounding out your position, maybe tell me if I'm wrong, some appreciation of the paradox of freedom and slavery.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Yes. And on this record, there is none. So, and that is why I see I'm well out of time.
Why doesn't the display of the nine names and the footprints make some statement about the paradox of freedom and slavery?
Your Honor, because without the panels, there's no explanation. Those are things in a void.
Isn't that the classic kind of curational issue that your friend was referencing? There's something about slavery there referenced. There's nine names. After you do that, isn't everything else kind of just a curational decision, something that judges really shouldn't be viewing how well someone displays a, you know, exhibit on a national park?
Respectfully, Your Honor, not in this space. Because of the way in which this space was created, that's not this case here. That may be in another one, but for here, this president's house was designed and installed with specific context. So to the extent curation is there are footsteps on the ground and names on a wall, without more, no one knows why those footsteps are there or why those names are on a wall. And what we have, again, this is on the record right now, what we have on the record is there is nothing to do that.
So the government cites the city's position with respect to the Columbus statue in its papers. How do you reconcile the city's position in the Columbus statute case with the city's position in this case?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, we lost, which is what we are saying the federal government should do here. There, the city said, we have a government speech right to do with what we will. And the Commonwealth Court in that case said, eventually, city, you may be able to do that, but you have to go through the correct processes first, which as we're making an arbitrary and capricious review claim, that is much akin to the claims that were made against us.
And the irreparable harm to the city, the government's suggesting that there is no irreparable harm to the city.
Yes, Your Honor, and our irreparable harm stems from my presentation about what this site is, which is where the city tells its specific history, and that the harm comes into play where A, the city no longer does so because there's no information up, and B, that it is particularly acute this year when it is the semi-quincentennial, Philadelphia, and it's in the record, expects 1.5 million visitors to come to Philadelphia. The president's house is at the doorway to the Liberty Bell. That history is not being told to all the people who are expected to come here. The city is not telling its history. And that event, and I would say the Liberty Bell, which is itself owned by the city in a building built by the federal government, that just again highlights that there is a long history of collaboration in this site and in this space and in this park.
And that's a right the city has itself. It's not a parents patriae. Right?
Correct.
Patriae is not the case.
Correct. This is not a case. And there was, I think, one of the cases was from Massachusetts where a town was suing the FAA.
Milton.
Yeah, because some of the noise from the planes was disturbing some of the townspeople. This is the city's history and the city's telling of its history that, you know, Mayor Street is quoted specifically as saying, this is the city's opportunity to tell the whole complicated truth. And without these panels up, that
and the only way to tell it is with the original display that was first erected.
Correct, Your Honor. The removal of the panels is wrong, and the court should affirm the district court for any or all of the reasons that we've discussed here today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Taylor. We'll hear from amicus, Ms. McClellan.
Good afternoon. Kara McClellan on behalf of Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, or ATTAC, and the Black Journey, as Amiki both are here with us today. I want to start by focusing on the foundation document. This is a case where Supreme Court precedent really controls under both Encino v. Navarro and DHS v. Regents. Those precedent tell us that when an agency changes its position, it must first actually acknowledge that it's changing position, second, give a reasoned explanation as to why, and third, consider the reliance interests. Here, appellants failed at each step. First, there was clearly a change in position. The foundation document made clear that the paradox of liberty and slavery was actually the significance of the site. Removing all discussions of slavery at the site is clearly a change in position. And just to take a step back, as counsel has explained, the managerial policies are what tell us how an agency can change its position. It's quite detailed under 2.1 and 2.2 in the managerial policies, and explaining that the foundation documents explain why the site matters, tell us why it was created, its purpose, its significance, and that they can be changed, but the managerial policies tell us how that change can happen.
So the foundation documents are part of the managerial policies?
The foundation document is created at every single site that National Park Service has for telling the purpose. The foundation document tells the purpose of the site that's required by the managerial policies. It's pursuant to the policies.
Isn't it the case that the managerial policies don't have any enforceable rights?
That's true, Your Honor, but also within the Supreme Court precedent that I just cite, those are cases in which the Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that even when you have non-binding policies, those non-binding policies are the way we determine if there was a change in position. So they can be considered. For example, in DHS v. Regents, right, it was a non-binding policy that had actually changed the country's policy on DACA. But the court found that even though it was non-binding, you had to consider the reliance interests. Similarly, in Encino Motor Car, that deals with a non-binding policy.
What are the reliance interests here? Because the site was completed, I believe, in 2012. Is that right?
It was completed in 2010.
2010.
So we have 15 years. We're 15 years of reliance interest here.
But the foundation document didn't come about till 2017.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the
how could you rely in 2010 on something that happened in 2017?
The foundation document is adopting what was included in the project development plan that was in the actual agreements, the 2008 agreement. It was an addendum that talked about the paradox of liberty and slavery. It talked about memory as a key value, history lost and found, never to be lost again. All of that was included in the agreement, and those principles are adopted in the foundation document. And they describe that the whole point of the site is to tell the story of the nine people who were held in slavery by President George Washington. It describes.
Doesn't that mean the city's rights are stronger under the cooperative agreements than under something that came later?
The city's rights, I just want to be clear, there's two separate claims that, so for the city's rights with regard to the cooperative agreement, that goes to the city's reliance on the enabling legislation, as well as all of the agreements that were adopted afterwards. Separately, there's an arbitrary and capricious claim that relies on the foundation document as a benchmark for showing us that there was a change in position. And all of the cases that I've just been discussing are cases where there was non-binding policy and it was used as the benchmark for seeing there was a change in position.
And what's the final agency action here under the APA?
It's the removal, the destruction of the site. I think it was put very well that it was an elimination of the site. It wasn't just curation. It was an elimination of all that was required in terms of the discussion of slavery, the paradox, the whole point of the site. I mean, after all, the site is called Slavery and Freedom and the Making of a New Nation. That's the name of the site for a reason. If I could turn...
What if we disagree with you that it's eliminate? What if we conclude that the retention of the names of the 9 enslaved people at the site and the footprints and the walls, what if we conclude that that's something less than elimination? Do you need elimination to prevail in this case, or can you prevail if it's something less than elimination?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. First, I would just point to the superintendent's declaration, which says that their goal was elimination. It was actually to take down the entire site. That's the record we have. There was no reason given. It was just a statement that they were taking down the entire exhibit. But even setting that aside...
Do you read that to include the walls and the footprints?
Well, it says that what was not taken down was not taken down because they did not have the tools to do so. That's what it says in the declaration. So, but even if there was just a partial removal, I think, again, it goes to what's included in the foundation document in terms of the paradox of liberty and slavery, being able to tell that story, the 9 people held in slavery. And again, when we think about the reliance interest, if I could turn briefly to that, there are organizations, there are people, there are tourists visiting this site who have relied on it to tell this information that isn't told anywhere else. This is the first federal site that memorialized enslaved people. That was a hard-won social and political inclusion for people who are descendants of enslaved people in this country. There's no other federal site at the time that recognized that experience.
What about President Johnson's home?
Well, to be clear, at this time, there was no memorial that recognized enslaved people in this way. This was the first memorial, and the National Park Service recognized it as such.
President Andrew Johnson's home, I think, has a slavery exhibit in it, doesn't it, in Tennessee?
I think what National Park Service has recognized is that there was, at the time, no memorial. This was the first time that there was a memorial that was created through community collaboration. But even if there are, just to be clear, even if now at this point there are other exhibits recognizing the experiences of enslaved people, this is a critical one. There's no, if I could talk about the reliance interests, considering, for example, the Black Journey, which gives place-based tours about Black history. Without this site, to be clear, they start 3 of their tours at this site because it is so critical to being able to tell the experience of Black history and the truth about the founding era. You can't really tell it without the site, because this is the one place where President George Washington lived and held people in slavery and actually had slave quarters added to the executive mansion.
You can't tell that story in the current status of the site?
No, Your Honor.
So the building, the walls, the footprints, the names on the wall, a good park ranger or tour guide couldn't tell the story of Hercules or Ona Judge or Paris or the other slaves that lived there. They couldn't tell the story of how President Washington moved them in and out of the state to avoid Pennsylvania. That story can't be told.
Well,
if that's true, that sounds like you're saying what this site is really all about were just the videos and the panels that were up, not all the things I just mentioned.
Well, the site was created intentionally to tell a holistic story. And that's why each of the pieces were designed through a deliberative process that involved community input. And to be clear, again, to go back to the managerial policies, they require that public input. They require historians serving as experts to provide documented evidence. all of that was included in creating the site. What we have left now is a very fragmented story. When you're there, you can't quite put together what it's supposed to mean because pieces of the exhibit are missing.
Let me just get in and test you with a little bit of a hypothetical. And it's not from this country, but it involves the Roman Colosseum. Assume that someone wanted to tell the story of Christian persecution in the Roman Colosseum, but all that they were allowed access to was the physical structure of the Colosseum. There was no videos, there was no names on the wall, there was no displays. And all that they could have would be the physical structure. That would still allow quite a conversation about Christian persecution, wouldn't it?
It's possible, but not everybody who visits the site, you know, has access to that information. The purpose of the exhibit was to create access to this information that had been kept from the public for many years. And once it was discovered, there was advocacy to ensure the public demanded the access to this information that has now been removed. If I could, just on the piece about telling the story someplace else, Your Honor, I think that the argument really misunderstands.
I didn't mean to suggest tell somewhere else. I meant tell it right there. Walk through there. You know, stand. But I mean, one of the benefits of the site, I think many of us in the room have been through it multitude of times. One of the benefits is you can stand right in it, right?
Exactly. I think,
and that's public space, right?
Yes.
But tour guides can go in there and stand there with school groups or other groups, tourists, and explain to them what it's all about, right?
That's true, Your Honor, but what the exhibit does is provide access to the full documented history. It tells you, what am I looking at? If you're just standing there looking at an archaeological dig, the average person doesn't know what that is. It takes the actual exhibit panels to explain to you. This is fundamental, as the National Park Service said itself, to the site, because this is where we discovered the slave quarters. It gives you piece by piece information to understand and interpret what you're seeing. And that's the value of National Park Service sites. To be clear, all of the National Park Service sites across our country are special because when you come there, you can actually encounter the history. And the job of the National Park Service, the mission of the Park Service, is to provide interpretation to help us understand why it matters. So saying, just to be clear, because appellants make this argument, it's not the case that you can just learn this information the same way somewhere else, because that's like saying that, well, why can't you just learn about the Gettysburg Address somewhere other than Gettysburg? There's something special about being where it occurred and encountering that information. And our classrooms, our national classrooms, as the National Park Service sites are called, give us a service by providing the interpretation that wouldn't exist.
You can go back to your reliance argument.
Sure.
Reliance by whom?
Reliance by the public here. And so I'm speaking about Amici as examples, right? If we think about Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, they rely on the site for public education. They rely on the site for organizing. They visit the site repeatedly and have done so for 15 years, including on key holidays for freedom and liberty, like the 4th of July. So right now, for example, just last week, they went to the site for Ona Judge Day. The materials that explain the significance on a judge are missing. That's their reliance interest. And we think about the Black journey. This is a case where an entire business, many businesses, have been built in reliance on this site. Black Journey has had to redesign its tours. It's had to retrain its tour guides, again, because they've relied on the materials that are at the site.
So, you know, your notion of the duty to consider reliance interest traces to two, I think, relatively recent Supreme Court cases in Sito Motor Cars and DHS v. Regents. So the answer is, well, do you have to do that? But I don't recall an executive order being present in those cases. Maybe there was in Regents, but I think that was all just what the DHS acting secretary was up to. But this case, we have an executive order. And I don't think anyone here is challenging the executive order. So it seems to me that this case is different than those cases because that was when the agency acted kind of on its own initiative, not pursuant to an executive order. What do you think, what do you make of the presence of the executive order in this case that I don't think was present, I know wasn't present in Encino, and I don't think was present in Regents?
Sure, Your Honor. And if I could just actually add one other Supreme Court case that stands for this proposition, which is FDA v. Wages and White Lion Laws. all of those are interpreting non-binding precedent or policy documents in this way. But with regard to the executive order, I want to be clear under the arbitrary and capricious analysis, no court has ever said that an executive order can be the reason on its own. There has to be some other reasoned explanation that the agency gives. And here we have
the cases, but the three, I mean, at one level, maybe they haven't, but they didn't have an executive order present in those cases, right?
It's true they did not have an executive order, but they had other policies that they were supposed to rely on.
But in Regents, the acting secretary, I think her name was Kristen Nielsen, she wasn't acting pursuant to an executive order in that case. She didn't say, I've changed the DACA rules from 3 years to 2 years, or I forget the details, that because I have an executive order that told me so. She just said, I'm going to do it. And isn't this case different because it doesn't have the kind of same, you know, genesis of agency, we're going to do this? It comes through implementation of an executive order. And when that happens, doesn't that change the arbitrary and capricious analysis?
Well, to be clear, I mean, I think if we stick with DACA, I mean, it was certainly the case that the executive branch was committed to the policy prior to the memo being released. But I don't think it changes the analysis to be clear that it was based on an executive order, because ultimately what we're talking about is an arbitrary and capricious analysis where there was a change in position. And it's never been the case that you can establish that an agency's action was an arbitrary and capricious based on an executive order alone. There has to be some other reasoned explanation from the agency. So
following an executive order is not good enough explanation for an agency's change of position, because presidents usually when they get into office, you know, there's usually a signing ceremony. They sign like 10 or 20 new executive orders. And at that point in time, after the president signs those, you're saying that principles of administrative agency then put it on the agencies to then go contemplate whether or not they're going to follow those changed executive orders. And if they don't do that, then that's an APA violation.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's black letter APA administrative law, that the agency actually has to give its own reason, and that just relying on the executive order on its own is not sufficient reason. No court has ever found that the executive order alone.
Do you have a cite for that proposition of black letter APA law?
Sure. I think Chenery is a cite for that, because that's an example of, there they say that you have to give more reason. It's not just, it can't be reliant just on the executive order. It has to be a reason from the agency itself.
Which case was that, sorry?
Chenery.
Chenery?
Yes.
Oh. Chenery, SEC?
But neither of the Chenery cases involved executive orders, did they?
No, but they're standing for the proposition that the agency itself has to give the reason.
I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything. There's no case for the black letter proposition that when an agency follows an executive order, it then has to do its separate own analysis for why it's doing so. There's no case that we could just cite and say, oh, that's, you know, the Smith case or the Jones case or the SEC case or whatever.
No, there are cases, I'm sorry, and I can pull cases to cite for that, because it's well established under Supreme Court precedent that you can't just rely on the executive order alone. You have to actually, a reasoned analysis by the agency. And we'd be happy to provide more case law on that, if that would be helpful. And I do think Chenery is relevant, because I do think that there was discussion within that case. I need to look back at it. But I do think there was discussion in that case about why it is that you have to actually have agency reasoned analysis and not just, rely on what the executive branch has said without the agency providing an analysis. If I may, Your Honor, I wanted to make sure to also address the point about the location as well, because I think this is critical. It's not just that the information, the access to information at the president's house itself is lost. Part of what National Park Service recognized, and this is to quote from the chief historian at the time, it's the juxtaposition that is an interpretive gift in terms of understanding paradox. The fact that the Liberty Bell is sitting upon the door to the Liberty Bell is right where the slave quarters of the executive mansion were, and immediately across from Independence Hall, where it was declared that all men are created equal. That collectively is what is significant and brings value. And the President's House exhibit was part of telling that story of the paradox. But it is the entire park and the juxtaposition together that matters. And then finally, I just want to point out, appellant suggests that these changes are minor, but again, this is the fundamental purpose. It was recognized at page 11 of the foundation document that the reason for the exhibit was the archaeological dig that discovered this history. Just one other point on section 551.10d, if I may. I wanted to point out the Texas v. United States Department of Homeland Security, the Fifth Circuit case that interprets the destruction of property. In that case, it was actually about private land. And so I just wanted to bring that up in response to the question about, is there any case law talking about whether the land has to be federal land? That case involved cutting and removal of wire that was installed on private land, and the court interpreted it as destruction of property. Finally, I want to just touch on the balance of equities and public interests, which overwhelmingly support the injunction. Each person who visits the park and does not learn the realities of the founding era receives a false account of history. This is a critical time for our country and in Philadelphia for people to come and be able to reflect and learn about the founding era. And preserving public trust and documented history at this critical time far outweighs unlawful action that has been taken without providing any reason. Just imagine if the government removed the Lincoln Memorial right before the bicentennial. That's the type of dangerous precedent that we must avoid here. So for those reasons and those provided by appellee, this court should affirm the district court's preliminary injunction. And I'm happy to take other questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your participation, Ms. McClellan. We'll hear rebuttal from Mr. Indenburken.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start with the notion of the agency action being a sanction here. I agree that that explicit statutory definition is the closest type of enumerated defined agency action that may apply here, but the actual language in 5 USC 551 subsection 10D is the destruction, taking, seizure, or withholding of property. As Judge Phipps pointed out, the most natural reading of that and the case that my friend on the other for Amiki just described is that it applies to the property of another. Withholding, destroying, or seizing property the government already owns cannot reasonably be described as sanctioning anyone.
Well, what if the other side has an interest in that property?
Then we're back to the very interest question we started with, which is, I heard my friend on the other side say, residual property right. I think the language Your Honor cited at JA254, I think my friend on the other side misspoke when she said that applies to the transference of intellectual property rights. That's the actual first operative provision in the agreement itself. It reads, upon completion of the exhibit in accordance with this agreement, ownership of the exhibit shall transfer to the National Park Service. NPS ownership of the exhibit shall survive any termination of this agreement. Staying with that for a second, the fact that they concede this is an act of interpretation is also fatal to their claim because there are numerous other provisions that provide responsibility for interpreting the site and the exhibit exclusively in the hands of the National Park Service. This is JA309. The project will be owned, maintained, managed, and interpreted by the NPS following completion of the project and acceptance by NPS. JA255, NPS agrees that it shall undertake all responsibility to manage, occupy, utilize, operate, repair, maintain, interpret, and administer the exhibit. This was an act of interpretation. It therefore falls in the agreement. They have disclaimed any residual property right. At the same time, returning to the sanction piece, there also wasn't any destruction, taking, or withholding or seizure of property here. It was already property that the government had. It took down its own property. Did not destroy it. Did not destroy the site.
And what do we make when we look at context of 551.10d, it also says taking. Usually the government never, you know, the takings clause is taking someone else's property. Usually when we say taking, the government isn't in the business of taking its own property. That's not what that's not the taking that the Fifth Amendment protected against. So if we want to read 10d so that property would mean the same thing throughout, doesn't that support, maybe I'm making a point for you, but doesn't that support the proposition that it has to be property that's non-federally owned?
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. I think the most natural way to read that clause is to apply the property of a non-federal entity. And as Your Honor pointed out, the rule towards strictly construing statutes governing with sovereign immunity likewise cuts in that direction.
So it's your argument that because this isn't a sanction, then there's no agency action at all, never mind final agency action?
Exactly. And I think my friend on the other side, when she stood up here, the only type of agency action she described, and this is the first time we've heard any specific enumeration of what type of agency action they're challenging, the only type they gave was a sanction under 551.10d. This is not a sanction. Therefore, there is no agency action. Therefore, their APA claims fail as a matter of law.
What if we say it is a sanction? Was it final?
I think the fact that we're talking about...
I mean, what if we say a sanction was agency action? Was it final agency action?
I think under Bennett, Your Honor looks to whether they are of an interlocutory temporal nature or whether legal consequences flowed from the action. I think the fact that we're talking so much about an incomplete record and these potential new signs and they're not being up strongly indicates that this was an interim step toward updating the signs rather than final agency action.
Can we consider that on this record? Ms. Taylor argues that you extra record. We can't consider that on this record.
I think the court can take the judicial notice of public sources, including those on governmental sites. Now, I don't think the court needs to for purposes of answering that question, because I think merely looking at the agency action in this case, the fact that they took the signs down, and the fact that there was an agency declaration that contemplated further action was to be taken.
How do we know that?
So the superintendent's declaration, and 2 points on that in particular. First, the Miki Council said at the footprints, and
this is the declaration that was filed in the district court.
Correct. This is the original declaration, specifically JA59, not the supplemental declaration. There was a point made earlier about how that actually said that further removal of the handprints and the names was contemplated. This is paragraph 4, the second sentence. However, the footprints in the concrete and the names on the memorial wall were to remain as is. It's true that this declaration contemplated further action, which is paragraphs 7 and 8. There, it talks about how there was another wood sign and a structure, and there were additional steps necessary to address that panel. But by the very language in this declaration, it says additional action is contemplated. I also think the pictures of the barren exhibit, I think it's a common sense inference that those weren't intended to be left bare. There was always, especially after the investment that both the Park Service and the city made in the site, there was always further action planned for this site. And I think it's a common sense inference the court can make on this record. Separately, I want to talk about the foundation document. I direct the court to page 19 of our reply brief. In the hierarchy of materials, the foundation document sits underneath the management policies. It is issued pursuant to the management
policies. How do we know that? Ms. Taylor said that it was beside it, not under it.
I think
in addition to it, not subject to it.
I think if you read the management policies, it explains that it is the operative sort of top level internal guidance and planning and management document that MPS issues, and any other materials are issued pursuant to its authority. But the management policies expressly disclaim enforceable effect. And I also want to note that this
that puts the rabbit in the hat. That presupposes that the management policies presuppose the foundation document. And I'm not sure you've persuaded us of that yet. How do we know that?
I think if you, I'd be happy to follow up with supplemental sites, but I think based on recollection, I will follow up happily, like I said, that the foundation document actually attributes its own terms to the management policies. On top of that, the way to think about this, the foundation document is park and site specific. The management policies are broadly applicable. They govern MPS conduct and internal planning site-wide, not site-specifically, meaning it, by necessity, sits at a sort of superior level because foundation documents are site-specific. Given that the management policies disclaim enforceable effect, foundation documents issued pursuant to the management policies also disclaim enforceable effect. And I would add to that that this is a different theory than what the city's claim actually was in the district court. if I could direct the court to JA 765-67, there they actually argued that there were barriers to the Park Service changing the foundation document. I see that I'm nearly out of time. If I may briefly continue. Given that that was their theory before, this notion that we could just unilaterally change the foundation document and then everything would be okay here doesn't withstand what they argued before. And I also don't think that the city would agree with that if that's the approach that the Park Service took. As for Encino and the other cases that were discussed earlier, each of those cases, barring White Lion, which I'm entirely familiar with, involved reliance interests and interpretation of binding actual interpretation of what the law was going to be according to the agency. In Encino Motor Cars, although it was in a letter, it was the interpretation of salesperson under the FLSA, how the agency was actually going to apply that interpretation going forward in official adjudications. I think that entirely distinguishes those cases from this, because under the APA, relief includes, and this is 551-11C, B, recognition of a claim, right, immunity, privilege, exemption, or exception. To the extent an agency sets forth a interpretation of law in which it, in the actual interpretation, gives an intent to be bound, this is an official interpretation going forward that we will apply in a binding fashion, it makes sense to actually treat that as final agency action and binding and hold the agency to its word. That is not what the case involved. So all those cases are distinguishable.
If the city is correct and the city retains residual interest in this exhibit based on the 2006 cooperative agreement and the three amendments that followed, do you lose the case?
To the extent that that's what roots, that's how their right is found and what it's predicated on.
Yes. I mean, I understand your argument is that once the site was constructed and the exhibits and everything there were donated to the NPS and the NPS retained the rights to interpret, manage, maintain, et cetera. It's your argument that the city's rights ended when that happened, correct?
There are residual rights in there, none that actually bar or apply, bar this action or apply in this case, as far as if the court were to find that there may be some residual.
All right, well, tell us what rights, residual rights remain that you concede.
I think the maintenance obligation is a fair one. I think by its terms, the fact that the Park Service undertook the responsibility to over time manage, maintain the site, if it let it fall entirely into dereliction, I think that would be a potentially enforceable.
If a bus careened off of Market Street and knocked everything down.
Precisely. Or if
these agreements require the National Park Service to rebuild it?
I think they require it to require them to manage it and maintain it, not in that situation, leave it entirely not operative, non-functional.
But maintain doesn't, in your worldview, doesn't mean preserving the status quo with respect to what and how things are displayed.
I think that's an atypical interpretation of what maintain means. It's not an ordinary interpretation. I also don't think it's consistent with exclusive property ownership. If you're actually giving a party an enduring right to actually direct you what to do with the property, I think that's different from maintenance. Now, as far as if we lose, whether there is some sort of enduring right based on the cooperative agreement, no, that claim still belongs in the Court of Federal Claims. And to the extent that the claim is based on the cooperative agreement, it's a contractual claim. Now, I heard my friend on the other side argue that this is a different type of agreement. There was consideration, there was offer, there was acceptance. There was clearly an exchange of mutual value, and the terms of the contract, therefore, are, by their plain terms, a contract. That's all that the Tucker Act requires. That's all that it governs. Therefore, any attempt to enforce the contract belongs in the Court of Federal Claims.
And all the city bought in the contract was the erection of the site, not its continuance.
I think
2 days after the site went up and the exhibits went up, the NPS said, sorry, we're going in a different direction and we're we're changing everything.
I think that's entirely accurate. And to the extent that the city says, well, we had an enduring expectation in a long
But I suppose it's your argument that if they really wanted it to be legal and legally enforceable, they should have put it in writing.
I think it's exactly right. I think the fact that we have a disharmony here between the press agreements and the actual contract is telling. I think to the extent that the city wanted that, it should have bargained for it. I also think if that enduring right had been bargained for, there would have been a very different exchange in consideration. For the federal government to provide a municipality with an enduring, never-ending veto right over federal property, I think that would require a lot more than funding of an exhibit.
Are there any instances of that being done anywhere else with National Park Service sites?
None that I know of, Your Honor. Finally, I want to end on this notion that omission of the signs renders every visitor's account false. Omission of particular facts is not stating any falsehoods. It's also not denying any facts. This history is available. People can view it. People can research it. And there is nothing stopping both AMICI as well as the city from telling its own history. The district court made the same mistake. It conflated curatorial decisions with erasure and denial. There was no denial here. There was no assertion or statement by the federal government that these facts were false, never happened, anything like that. It was a curatorial decision. They wanted to change and update the signage with the signs that are currently listed on the NPS's website. That is not the same thing as falsifying historical facts or denying that they occurred. For all these reasons, this court should vacate with instructions to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Indenburken. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Thank you, Ms. McClellan. Court appreciates the briefing and the oral argument. We'll take the matter under advisement.